If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode. Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. How did prehistoric people in Britain view and understand the world around them? What did they smell, hear and see? Francis Pryor is one of Britain's leading archaeologists and a familiar face from TV series such as Time Team. Following the publication of Francis's new book, Scenes from Prehistoric Life, our content director Dave Musgrove caught up with him to talk all about the prehistoric mindset.
So yeah. Francis, welcome to the podcast. Your new book, Scenes from Prehistoric Life, From the Ice Age to the Coming of the Romans, has just been published. It's a great book, so congratulations on that, and thank you very much for joining us on the podcast. First up, how are you?
I'm very well, actually, Dave. Yes, feeling remarkably relaxed.
Good stuff. So, as I said, it's a really interesting book covering a very big topic, a lot of time, loads of detail and colour and loads of stories covered. And obviously, we can't hope to cover all the riches that you talk about. But what I was hoping to do in the course of this conversation is to focus in a bit on a few topics that I think are interesting, trying to understand maybe a little bit about how prehistoric people might have viewed the world that they existed in. And when I say prehistoric, obviously that's a very big term to use, and I'm going to sort of invite you to pick moments from the topic when I ask you the questions. But firstly, I think before we jump into it, what we need to do is just define prehistory for our listeners. Would you be able to give us a very top level summation of what we mean by prehistory and the various periods within it?
Right. Well, in a nutshell, prehistory means before history. And history is written history. So basically, you're talking about people who lived before the introduction of writing. And in Britain, that happened with the arrival of the Romans in AD 43. So prehistory is essentially everything that happened in Britain before the life of Christ, is probably the simplest way of looking at it. And it's divided up into three broad periods. The oldest, which goes from about a million years ago, is the Stone Age. And then that continues through the Ice Age into post-Ice Age times, when you get the Middle and the New Stone Ages. So in the Ice Age and earlier, it's the Old Stone Age. And then you get the Bronze Age, and that starts around 2500 BC. And that continues until about 750 BC, when you have the Iron Age. And so there are your three ages, the ages of stone, bronze, and iron. And bronze is a mixture of copper and tin, and iron is just the metal iron. So basically, what those three ages are telling us is how technology changed. So in the Stone Age, you're bashing stone. You're not using much heat. And then in the Bronze Age, you're starting to melt metal and make pottery and that sort of thing. And so that requires the manipulation of heat. And so it's quite a jump in technology. And then when you get to the Iron Age, it requires a lot of heat. And so that really is quite a big step in technological development.
Okay, thank you. So listeners, try and keep those broad distinctions in your mind as we go through this conversation. Now, Francis, you've had a very interesting career, I think, and it might be useful just to ask you to summarize a few of the things you've done, because you're much more than just a practicing archaeologist. You have dug and done a lot of digging, but you've done a few other interesting things as well, and I guess your activities help inform your view of the past. So maybe you could just give us a very brief summation of your career, your varied career, and maybe give us a little taste of what you're trying to do with this book, because you've written quite a few books on this topic.
Yeah. Yes. Well, I was I read archaeology at Cambridge because I'd always been very interested in the subject, and largely because when I was a schoolboy, I did geology and botany and zoology, and I loved those subjects, but they lacked something, and what they lacked was people. And I really wanted, when I went to university, to do a subject that involved people. And archaeology was what came to mind. And I went on many digs and did that sort of thing. And then when I finished at university, I very nearly stopped being an archaeologist. And I was offered a job by Brian Epstein, who was the manager of the Beatles, because I did a lot of work for college balls at Cambridge, and he offered me a job as a road manager. And like a madman, I turned it down because he was offering me £50 a week. And I think if I was doing well on a dig, I'd be getting a fiver a week. But at any rate, I turned it down and started doing a bit of digging. And then I realized that I wasn't really getting anywhere. And I thought I'd better do something new. So I went to Canada on an impulse and got a job at the Royal Ontario Museum in Toronto for 10 years. And then I decided I'd come back to England and work on British sites. And then I did a lot of that. I was busily digging sites ahead of the development of Peterborough Newtown. And then when was it? About 1980, I thought, I'm digging up sites of farms, prehistoric farms, Bronze and Iron Age farms, and I'm writing about how they managed their livestock and how they laid out their fields, and yet I've got no real practical hands-on experience of what I'm digging up. Even though my family were farmers, you know, I didn't actually know what it was like to run a farm. So I bought some land, bought about 50 acres of land, slowly, it took a bit of doing, and built up a flock of a couple of hundred sheep. And I kept them for about 35 years. So I had a sort of medium-sized sheep farm that was paid me 2 days a week. And so I was an archaeologist and a part-time sheep farmer. And that's when I started writing books, and I did 20 years of television with Time Team. So, you know, I've led quite a varied life, and running through it all has been archaeology.
So so you could have been a Beatles roadie, but weren't, but yeah. You have been a farmer. So would the Beatles have been interested in archaeology, do you think?
That's interesting. I doubt it. Although I don't know, they're very intelligent chaps. But yeah.
And then, so this latest book, what's your idea here? What story are you trying to tell?
Well, the idea of Scenes from Prehistoric Life is I want to get inside the heads of people living in the prehistoric past. What were they thinking about when they visited Stonehenge, say? Or what were they thinking about when they built their houses, when they milked their cows? Why were they doing these things? Because while I was being a farmer myself, I got a completely different slant on life, because people would turn up, other farmers would turn up on the farm, and we talk about livestock and livestock management and diseases that sheep get and all the rest of it. And we also talked about their families and, you know, how they live their lives. And I was given a totally different slant on life. And I thought, well, wouldn't it be good if I could actually discover more about the way prehistoric people would have lived their lives? You know, what a husband and wife would have talked about as they sat down to a meal of marsh samphire or whatever it was they were eating, you know, and what would their food have tasted like? And what was the motivation that drove them to cook and to eat food? And, you know, what was it like being a child in the Iron Age? Did you go to school? We don't think they did. But so how did you learn your family's history and the history of your settlement and community? And a lot of the sites that they constructed in prehistoric times were very elaborate. I mean, you know, Stonehenge, everybody knows, is mathematically quite sophisticated. So, you know, there was knowledge. People had knowledge. But how did they regard their knowledge? And this is something that, you know, we've got to think about quite carefully. Because one of the things that worries me about people's attitudes to the past is that people tend to patronize the past. They think they were simple. Whereas in reality, I think the breadth of their experience was a great deal wider than ours. I don't necessarily think that, you know, humanity has progressed hugely as we've moved forward in time. You know, I sometimes think if some of the attitudes of some political leaders had been prevalent in the past, I know, would they have thrived the way that some dictators and people have in the present day? You know, would Hitler have been possible in the Iron Age? Personally, I rather doubt it. Because I think in some respects they were more civilized than us.
Okay. So I mean, we might explore whether Hitler might have been possible in the Iron Age towards the end of the conversation. That's an interesting, very interesting observation. But what I want to do now is just throw you a bunch of questions, which are going to sound a bit vague and airy-fairy. I'm going to use the word, did prehistoric people do stuff? Obviously, as discussed, prehistory is a very long period of time. So I'm going to ask you a question, then invite you to sort of pick moments and topics which might helpfully answer the question. So my first question is, did prehistoric people appreciate the good view? Now, that might sound a bit silly, but I'm sort of referencing a point in your book where you talk about the Goat's Hole Cave, which you might want to tell us a bit more about in your answer, and the sense of that position in the landscape and how it looks out over an area. So what do you think? Did prehistoric people appreciate a good view?
Right. The big problem with this is that our appreciation of views is of their beauty. And it's their beauty as we have been taught to appreciate it by people like Wordsworth and, the people who sung the praises of the Lake District in the late 18th and early 19th century. That concept of beauty, of landscape, is relatively recent. I mean, the word landscape didn't exist in the English language until I think it was about the 17th century when it was introduced from Holland. And the set piece view that you look at for its own sake, well, of course, that's rubbish. You don't look at it for its own sake. You look at it because of what it does to you. And prehistoric people would have regarded the landscape in a very, very different way to the way we do. For example, distant hills, that sort of thing, wouldn't just be seen as a beautiful range of hills in the distance. That would have been the edges of the realm of the ancestors. That's where, you know, dead people probably went to when they ceased this life. People had an idea that parts of the landscape were bridges to other realms. Water in particular, the sort of sites that I dig in the fens, people make offerings to. Thousands of spears, daggers, shields, all sorts of things were carefully placed in the water. Because once the dagger had been placed in the water, it passed from the land of the living to the land of the dead, because you go below water and you drown. But you look at water and you can see your own reflection. So it's a mirror of the soul. There's archaeologists use a word to describe this, which is, it's numinous and it's liminal. Numinous means it's of the other world. And liminal means it's on the boundary, from the Latin word limen, meaning a boundary. And some sites are liminal. They're on the boundary between the world of the ancestors and ours, like the Goat's Hole Cave in South Wales, in Pevelland, which is a cave which has on the edge of what would have been a huge plain, but is now the sea. And in that cave, there was a burial of a body which had been surrounded and covered in red ochre, red dust, red paint. And it was always assumed when it was first dug that it was a lady and that she was probably a prostitute, because red is for prostitution. But when the bones were looked at professionally by scientists, they turned out to be male, so that blew that theory apart. But basically, it was a ceremonial burial thousands of years ago in a place which was on the edge of the known, experienced world. And caves often were treated like this. They were very special places. And so a view to a prehistoric person would mean far more in some respects, I think, than a pretty view as we'd see it.
So that's a really interesting answer. So obviously you're theorizing to a great extent here, because we don't know, you know, as you said in your initial definition, we don't know what prehistoric people thought. We have no writings. So how concrete can you be in these answers when you talk about prehistoric people seeing a landscape as a landscape of the dead, for instance? What is the evidence for making those sorts of comments?
The best evidence is the sighting of, for example, Bronze Age burial mounds. They're often on along the line of the top of a hill. They're carefully positioned to be seen from roundabout, and you see them sticking up as humps. The landscape we'll get onto it later, at Stonehenge, has got barrows all around the great stones, but separated well back from it, most of them. It's the positioning of these sites. The wet sites are particularly notable. They're often on streams and rivers that probably form boundaries. And rivers naturally form a boundary, a territorial boundary. So these sites would have been areas where people of different ethnicities, perhaps, but more likely just different tribal traditions, would meet and converse in special neutral places. And those special neutral places were later developed into large sort of camp-like areas where people could get together and feast and build little halls. And they're rather special sites. And these sites are never just at random. Everything is very carefully positioned. And that's why I think they had structure to their view of the past. And can I be certain of these things? No, of course I can't. But one of the great things about archaeology is it frees you up to use your imagination. And I do get slightly fed up with some academic approaches, which say it's all about analysis, it's all about building models and blah, 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 blah. No, it isn't. You know, if you're going to understand human culture, as James Joyce knew only too well, you must use your imagination.
Thinking about sight and the way people saw things, one of the really interesting aspects to this story, I think, and what something you talk about in the book a bit, is colour and how prehistoric people might have viewed colour and particularly sort of shiny things. What have you got to say about that?
Yes, well, I mean, we have this, I just mentioned it with the Red Lady of Pevelland. you know, the red ochre is an important part of Stone Age rituals. Colour and shininess, I think a lot of these things are about reflection, because we take certain things for granted. They're part of our lives. I mean, for example, we all know what we look like. Yeah. Every single person living today checks his face in the mirror 3 or 4 times a day, I should think. And if he's looking at his mobile phone, he's doing it more often. And, you know, you know yourself intimately, and you wouldn't have been able to do this in prehistory. People didn't have mirrors. Mirrors came along with glass. The earliest mirrors turn up in the last few centuries BC, and they're polished copper. They're beautifully decorated. When you actually look at them, you don't get a clear reflection of yourself, because it's the surface isn't as flat as you can get it with a machine. So it undulates and you get quite a distorted picture of yourself. But people obviously desperately wanted to be able to see their reflection. And they're usually found associated with women, and they're beautifully decorated on the non-reflecting side. Britain is famous for various things. Very few major artistic movements originated in Britain. We're very much better at science. But English country gardens are one, and the other thing is Celtic art. And the Celtic art of the Iron Age is best seen on mirrors and certain types of pottery and things. But it was a very important artistic movement that had influence right across Europe. And, you know, you've got to try to get inside of the head of these people. You know, what was motivating them to create these remarkable objects? And they were clearly very moved. And so, yes, I'm a great fan of mirrors.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
And I went into the temple, as it probably was, but it was being constructed, and I was almost hit in the face by the strength of the smell. It actually pulled my skin and made my eyes water.
What about sort of colours as well? That's sort of how prehistoric people might have seen colours. I mean, I was reading something, this is a bit out of our period actually, but reading about a Viking burial in Scandinavia where the excavators talked about the barrow itself being created out of a kind of a bluey mud, and they kind of felt that might have been a significant aspect of the initial barrow creation. Can we say anything about how people viewed colours specifically in the past?
Yes. They had a subtle appreciation of colour. We know that from fabrics that have been found, some at Must Farm in the Fens, where the actual pattern in the fabric is very subtle. It's delicate, careful colouring. You mustn't assume that people like garish colours. I think they had a subtle appreciation of colour. One of the best examples of unusual colour that was very important are some flints that were found at a site called Blick Mead near Stonehenge. And the water in the spring where these flints were found has dyed the stones a screaming pink. It's extraordinary colour. It's actually algae in the water that do the dyeing, and they live in the water. And this site became very important from a religious point of view a long time ago, you know, going back 6,000 BC or thereabouts. So, you know, colour obviously did matter to people, as did smell, you know.
Actually, let's move on to smell and sound, if we can, sort of going around the senses a bit. Can you sort of get into the prehistoric sensory experience at all. Obviously, that smell and sound don't really survive in archaeological context. But what can you say about them?
Sound does survive in the archaeological context, in as much as the musical instruments survive. A close friend of mine who lives just across the fens from me in March, he's a paleomusicologist, and he has made recreations of Iron Age and Bronze Age musical instruments, which, you know, one always assumed were sort of played in a rather crude way, you know. But no, when Graham plays these things, they're beautifully subtle, absolutely wonderful. So the music, I think, could be extremely subtle. And you got to think, you know, think of African tribal rhythms. Again, they're amazingly subtle and difficult to do. And so I think that there's no reason on earth why Iron Age and Bronze Age music, and make no mistake, they would have sung and had music, couldn't have been really remarkably sophisticated. It just, unfortunately, it hasn't survived yet. I don't know. And smell, I had an extraordinary moment a long time ago, back as a, just sort of 2000 AD, I should add. We were digging a site called Seahenge on the North Norfolk coast, which was a circle of 55 timbers with an upside-down oak tree in it. And that site was constructed in the year 2049 BC, between April and June. We know that because of the tree ring dates. And we made a film about this on Time Team. It was one of the first Time Team documentaries. And as part of making the documentary, we did a recreation, a reconstruction, full-sized reconstruction of the timber circle. And it was a ring of 55 posts, oak posts, all split, set edge on edge to make a solid wall with a very narrow entrance. And then in the middle was the upside-down oak tree, which had its bark stripped off. Now, splitting the outside posts and removing the bark from the oak tree, I don't think was purely done to spin out the timber. I think it was done to release the smell of the tannic acid that is a part of oak. And when we made the reconstruction, I can remember the team broke up to have a tea break, and everyone was over at the cafe caravan getting their tea, and I went into the temple, as it probably was, but it was being constructed, and I was almost hit in the face by the strength of the smell. It actually pulled my skin and made my eyes water. Now, I'm sorry, but if you're having someone, probably your father or your mother, laid in the roots of this upside-down tree, and at the same time, that's their body, and at the same time, you're having this powerful smell of tannic acid, it's going to be an unbelievably strong emotional moment. I don't see how anyone could come through that without floods of tears.
So you're imagining there are people deliberately employing smell as a sensory experience to achieve some sort of end.
I mean, absolutely no doubt of it, having done it. Yes, no doubt.
So what we really need now is the smell-o-vision, isn't it? To get a sense of what does that smell like? Is it? Can you describe it? What's it like?
Tannic acid. What's it like? It's like really strong vinegar soy sauce mix. It just pulls your face. It's extraordinary smell. Makes your eyes water. It really is an extraordinary smell. I can't describe it. It's not like anything I've ever smelled before.
Right. Well, it sounds very, very powerful.
Yes.
So that smell. Just going back to sound a bit. You talked about the instruments. I wonder. prehistory famous for its architecture as much as anything else in terms of the structures that survive, stone circles and burial mounds and the like. Is there anything in sort of the architecture of those places that is linked to sound, do you think? I mean, a lot of people, well, a theory has been made that there was something in Stonehenge in terms of the way it's set up to hold sound or move sound around. Do you hold a view on that?
Yes, there has been work, and undoubtedly in certain prehistoric sites, one of the most famous ones is the tomb Maes Howe in Orkney, where the sound is amplified. I'm sure they manipulated these things. Absolutely sure of it. These were very able people, I don't think it was ever simple. It's often said that these sites were intended to strike ore. They were, but ore is quite a complex emotion. Why do you feel a sense of awe? And I think if your sense of awe can be linked to personal connections, so, you're thinking, my God, dear Dad, who departed a week ago, is beyond that place, to me, that's more awe-inspiring in some respects than going to Westminster Abbey and seeing Poets' Corner. It's personal awe. And one of the things about life in prehistory, I think, is that the family was so important. I've written a book earlier on about sort of family life in prehistory, and it's something I feel very strongly about. And I think it was women who played a major part in giving structure to prehistoric life and a feeling of community. We've got to embrace the complexity of, what it meant to be a human being in prehistory. And I think it was as complex as it is today and as rewarding.
And just for our listeners, Maes Howe, that's up in Orkney. It's a Neolithic site, part of a much broader Neolithic landscape. We might come back to that if we've got time to. But an amazing, amazing place to visit. Just picking up on what you were just talking about there in terms of family. One of the other really interesting things I took from your book is your observations on prehistoric attitudes to time, and I guess that links into family in terms of ancestors. You cite a really interesting example of a prehistoric site in Scotland called Tomnaveri, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, which seems to have been planned and developed over the course of millennia, which is clearly a very long time. What does that tell us about prehistoric attitudes to time, to planning, to looking at the long durée, I guess? And how do we know it was planned over millennia? Actually, might be a good place to start.
We know that it was planned over millennia because we can actually date the phasing of the various sites in the area and how they changed. And you can do that with radiocarbon dating, so, you can do it accurately. So we're in no doubt about that. What fascinates me about time in prehistory, and indeed in time in early history, is the way it was regarded today and for, the last 300-400 years. We regard time in terms of hours, minutes, seconds, weeks, months, years. And they're all numbered. Time is, something which passes and is finished. It's gone. It's successive, and there is no sense of time ever repeating itself. In prehistory, I think, in fact, there's evidence to back this up, that people's attitudes to time were far more cyclical, circular, just as they are still today in rural areas. So one of the things I learned when I started being a full-time sheep farmer was that when you were talking to other farmers during lambing, say, you'd go round and you probably hadn't been to bed for 12 hours, and you'd go round to see your neighbour and you'd be talking about the lambing. And I'd find that sometimes my neighbours, who you know, were sometimes quite elderly people, would be talking about problems they had lambing back in the 1950s, as if they were yesterday. Each lambing season has its own characteristics, which are often revisited year after year. So, you know, in some years you're having a lot of retained afterbirth and that sort of thing, but that's probably due to the condition of the grass and, as stated, the mineral content of the soil and so on. And these things come back, and there's a sense of the cycle of the seasons. Spring gives way to summer, gives way to autumn, gives way to winter, and each year is slightly different, but it's also slightly similar. It's linked by these similarities. And in prehistory, it was the cycle of the seasons that lay behind a lot of their religious thinking. It's not for nothing that the henges are circular, and you know, the emphasis is on circularity. Iron Age houses are circular, and they're very often built in the same way, with the doorway facing southeast, so over, you know, rising sun, and a central fireplace and hearth. And then people ate and prepared food on the south side of the hearth. The head of the family, or the most important person, had his or her chair facing the doorway. And then on the north side of the fireplace was the side where you slept. And that's, incidentally, when you do have burials, as sometimes you have child burials and that sort of thing in these houses, they're always on the north side, at least nearly always. So what the layout of those buildings is reflecting is the passage of the hours during the day. So you have a very complex view of the world with the cyclical seasons and the passage of time in a circular way. And I don't think they would have thought in a linear way the way we do.
So that's fascinating. You're absolutely right to identify the circularity of a lot of the structures. But they're not exclusively circular. I mean, there are long barrows, which are, mm-hmm. which sort of break that mould, and they have been interpreted to be a slightly different vibe, haven't they, in terms of reflecting, well, you're going to be able to explain this better than me, in terms of farmers coming in and having a more communal attitude to the past, if I remember my archaeology correctly. Actually, that brings on an interesting point. I wonder whether you see anything different in terms of the perception of self, and you talked about how people looked at mirrors and sort of trying to understand their visage. But is there a sense that there was a different perception of the individual versus the community in prehistory? And was it more focused on community and the long story of protecting a sort of a lineage, perhaps, rather than our more, certainly our Western European, more individualistic approach?
Yes, that's a very good point. I think the community did matter more, but I think this also applied in the Middle Ages. You know, if you look at the illustrations in the Lateral Psalter and some of the extraordinary medieval illustrations of village life, I think the community was very important. I think we get a very good idea of the relationship of the individual to the community if you examine burials in long barrows. So now, long barrows were built just after 4000 BC by the earliest farmers, Neolithic people. And these are mounds of earth with a central chamber And bones are very often placed in side chambers off the central chamber or passage. And when people started, modern archaeologists started examining and excavating long barrows, they found these burials, at least very often they were collections of bones. And when they examined them closely, what they found was not complete skeletons with everything present as you'd expect if you laid someone to rest, as we would do. What they found were, yes, skeletons, but very partial, missing all sorts of bits and pieces, you know, toe bones, leg bones, whatever, you name it, they were missing it. And the more they examined it, the clearer it became that these bodies were actually taken out into the community and maybe circulated through henges and important places. I don't know. None of us know. Maybe back to the houses where they came from. And quite often, you know, the actual bodies weren't treated as being particularly important because bits of bones were missing. It was what the bones represented. It was John Smith that was important. And, you know, if when you returned John Smith to the barrow, he was missing his big toe, too bad, you know, it didn't really worry you. But what it's telling us is that these ancestors were important to the community more so than a family, because they're buried in a communal grave, and yet at regular intervals they were taken out back into the community. And I think they played an important part in providing social stability and cement that held a community together.
I guess, as you said, these long barrows tend to date from the earlier Neolithic period. So that's when farming is becoming established. I guess you need fairly strong communities to allow for effective farming. That sort of brings me on to another point, which is one of the biggest fracture points in prehistory is the transition between the Mesolithic and the Neolithic, the Middle Stone Age and the New Stone Age, hunter-gathering to farming, or at least that's how it's kind of, you know, it's supposed to be a stark division, and that's the archaeological nomenclature. Is that, was it a stark division? And what do you think it meant in terms of sort of the site? Was it a different psyche between your hunter-gatherers and your farmers, or did they sort of just sort of knock along quite well together?
Very good question. My own feeling, I mean, if you'd asked me this question 30, 40 years ago, I'd have said there was a sharp split, very sharp split, and that, you know, hunter-gatherers were far more mobile than farmers who settled down, and, you know, it was a very big change, partly introduced by people coming in from the continent who brought with them the idea of farming itself. But since then, my attitudes have changed, partly through a lot of my own work, actually, my own team's work. And one of the things we found when we were digging in Peterborough is that the landscape remained substantially structured in the same way for at least 4,000 years. And there were indications that original structure probably went back a long time, a long way, back into Mesolithic, into hunter-gatherer times. For example, you know, most of the islands in the fens, and these are the drier bits of land that would have been islands before drainage, the Mesolithic, the hunter-gatherer flint flakes are always found, almost without exception, in the same places as Neolithic flakes for farmers. And we know that the arrival of farmers didn't represent a complete population change. It was only a part of the population, probably, I don't know, estimates keep varying, but maybe a third of the population came into the country from outside. So I don't think that the distinction between hunter-gatherers and farmers was quite as big as we were taught when I was a student. For example, I mean, we know that dogs were domesticated. Dogs were domesticated by at least 8,500, maybe even 9,000 BC. We know that for a fact. And if you can domesticate a dog, well, it's not a huge leap to domesticate other things. There's some evidence that hazelnuts, for example, could well have been planted around the edge of woods. And they have to be managed in a very different way, hazel has, if you're going to extract, if you're going to use them as a source of nuts, as opposed to a source of wattle work for building hurdles and building walls of your houses. Those bushes have to be cut to the ground, and you don't get nuts if you coppice a hazel. So, you know, I think people did understand managing the landscape much more than we give them credit for in the hunter-gatherer period. And we know for a fact that they were coppicing, because we found evidence for it at sites like Star Car from 8,000 BC. My own feeling is that the country was starting to be divided up at the end of the Ice Age, and then it got increasingly partitioned. And we always think of migrant hunter-gatherers, that the Mesolithic hunter-gatherers were itinerant, that they wandered around at random. No. That's not the case. We know for a fact that many of them followed a fixed route where you were able to exploit different environments at different times of the year. And you didn't do it at random. You did it within your territory so that you didn't conflict with other people. You avoided friction. And there's a lot of evidence for this. So that, there wasn't a rapid switch from migrants heading all over the place at random to settled farmers. It just didn't happen like that, because people, before the arrival of farming, were living very structured lives in structured territories that everyone would have respected.
So again, that kind of plays back into your general idea about people having quite a long view on the past. So you're seeing continuity there between those two groups, rather than a case of I'm a hunter-gatherer, so I'm different to you, you're a farmer. That you don't see that sharp divide. I wonder, you just mentioned sort of travel and movement there and how structured it might have been. What you can say about prehistoric people's attitude to travel and movement, and whether they wanted to travel for travel's sake, perhaps, as you know, that's quite a modern concern, isn't it? People like to just go on holiday, travel to places. Was that a thing in prehistory? Did people just travel because travel was an interesting thing to do?
That's a very interesting point. There may have been an element of that. I'm sure there was. Younger people are always going to want to travel around, I think. But for a start, I think the most important thing is that travel took place far more often in Britain than we take, than we think. There have been bodies discovered near Stonehenge, for example, where the dead person had actually spent their youth in the Alps. And we know that from the analysis of the enamel of their teeth and that sort of thing. And we know from the discovery of the boat at Dover, the Bronze Age boat at Dover, is about, I'm trying to remember, about 1500 BC or thereabouts, that that boat was perfectly capable of crossing the channel. It was a seagoing vessel. And we know about the remains of Bronze Age wrecks along the south coast, because we found the Bronze Age cargoes lying on the seabed. I suspect that around 1500 BC, there was probably ships crossing the channel every day, unless it was a real storm blowing. But, most days there would have been several ships crossing the channel. So there was regular to-ing and fro-ing between Britain and the mainland in Europe. Now, you get something similar inland with places like Stonehenge, for example. People came there from a long, quite a long way away. Many links have been established now between places like Stonehenge. Well, the famous link with Stonehenge is with the South Wales and the Bluestones, which came from South Wales. And there's been a lot of research done recently by Mike Parker Pearson and his teams, which actually show that the stones used at Stonehenge probably came from, in fact, almost certainly, came from a burial mound that was deliberately taken apart and taken to Stonehenge to be used in the site there. And it was always thought, oh, well, you know, this would have been done the most cost-effective way, cheap and easy way. In other words, put them on a boat and, you know, take them down to Stonehenge by sea. But no, they were probably taken over land. And, you know, had to be put on a boat at some point, but for the short distance, then over land, because the point of moving the stones was for people along the way to see them and to respect them. And it was part of the ritual of building the new site. And to go back to our earlier point about the hunter-gatherers and the Neolithic farmers, Stonehenge is the most famous Neolithic monument of them all, Neolithic and Bronze Age monument. And it's built on a landscape that had been very important to people for at least 4,000, 5,000 years before the stone started being erected. So it was part of a long-standing tradition, which is another reason why I don't think that there was a clean break at any point when the farmers arrived. They continued to respect places that had been important religiously to people in the Mesolithic times, right back to pretty well to the Ice Age. I mean, some of the earliest evidence for a Stonehenge being important in very early times came when they excavated a trench near the Healstone, which is the stone that sort of guards the entrance to Stonehenge. And when this trench was first excavated, they didn't realise what they'd found. It was only Mike Parker Pearson's team going back to it later showed it's too potential. And that this is quite a wide trench. And it had been dug down to the underlying chalky limestone. And the stone at that point was traversed by a series of deep cracks, fissures, which had formed during the Ice Age and were aligned precisely on the solstice, like Stonehenge. So the avenue, the processional avenue that leads into Stonehenge is aligned on the solstice, but it's also aligned on these cracks in the soil underneath. And you wouldn't have been able to see those cracks when Stonehenge was built, because they had been buried under layers of soil accumulating. So they would have been known about shortly after the Ice Age, from about 6,000 BC. And that's one of the reasons why the site became famous religiously.
So that, I think, is one of the most fascinating things. This idea, again, it goes back to this really long perception of time of yep. You know, as you say, Stonehenge then has a really long backstory. It behoves people to have understood that and respected it and known that, you know, there was some sort of history there. Mm-hmm. Sort of wrapping up a bit, because we've chatted for a little while now. You've talked about Stonehenge a bit. Stonehenge is, as you say, probably the most famous prehistoric site in Britain, though maybe some of those places in Orkney would have something to say about it as well. I just wonder, it's certainly the most visited, I think, is, you know, one of English Heritage's most popular visitor attractions and most iconic prehistoric sites now for people. So are we saying that Stonehenge and the Stonehenge environs, because archaeology has shown that it was, you know, it was much more than just the stone circle. It was important to the whole landscape around it. Was it a super important place in prehistory, and were other places as well that similarly important? I mean, was the Orkney Neolithic complex a comparator to Stonehenge in terms of importance? What do we know about that?
The short answer is we strongly suspect that Stonehenge and Orkney were, if not the significant Stone Age Neolithic religious sites. But I think in some respects it's rather missing the point, because where was the wealth coming from that allowed places like Stonehenge to be built? Because it's Salisbury Plain is not naturally very rich. You know, it's not, I mean, compared to the landscapes where I work in the Fens, you know, we don't have stones, so we can't have Stonehenges, but we have huge timbers, and, you know, the soil is as fertile as anywhere in Europe. And the Thames Valley is immensely fertile. Huge areas of lowland England had landscapes, so-called ritual landscapes, so, you know, barrows and henges and other ritual sites that compare very well with Stonehenge. And they've completely gone. So I think that's why I'm slightly hesitating, because we don't know whether some of the timber henge monuments could not have been as elaborate and you know, special as Stonehenge. And of course, they would have been closer to the centres of population, which Stonehenge never was. So yes, I do think Stonehenge is an extraordinary place. But, you know, little old Seahenge is just, you could tuck it in one of the stones, probably, of Stonehenge. But in some ways, for me, it does it for me better. I mean, we've probably learned more about prehistory from a site like Seahenge than even, well, perhaps I'm going to be a bit careful about saying this, but, I mean, what other site in the world in prehistory can you make a reasonable estimate of the number of people it took to build it? At Seahenge, there were 51 axes used, as we know this from the cutting edges of their blades. So that tells us that the team erecting Seahenge could probably have been about 200 people, if you allow for partners and whatever. And just after we'd finished digging at Seahenge, I was driving home, and I had to pause in the village because there was a funeral, and the road was blocked because, you know, the hearse was having to reverse into the church. And I looked across the churchyard, and I counted the number of people in the churchyard waiting for the hearse to arrive, and there were about 200. And I suddenly thought, as a direct link to prehistory. It gives you some idea of the scale of the ceremonies involved and really how things haven't changed that much.
Okay. One last thing. We've covered quite a lot of ground, and hopefully it's been illuminating for our listeners. But I wonder, is there one sort of final takeaway that you'd like our listeners to the podcast, and indeed readers of your book, to come away with in terms of understanding prehistoric people and the way they thought about things? Because when you talk about Stonehenge in the book, you, as you said earlier on, you warn against making patronising assumptions about prehistoric societies and their presumed simplicity. What would you like us to sort of understand about prehistory that perhaps is not well understood?
That they were exactly like us. They had a different way of looking at the world, but their attitudes to their mother, their father, their children, their families would have been, you know, the same. If you could, I sometimes think if I could go back and spend a week with a Bronze Age family living in a Bronze Age house, and assuming I could speak the Bronze Age language. I don't think it would be that different at all from going to visit friends nowadays. So what I'm trying to say is that they were like us. They were us. We mustn't think of them as being different. And that's what I think is terrible about attitudes to history and to the distant past today. You know, it's a series of events that go back in X, Y, and Z, but they were people. And we must remember that they experienced life just as we do. I'm really feeling this coming out of lockdown. You know, we're starting to rediscover the modern world. And prehistoric people would have had this sort of experience too. There would have been diseases. You know, coming out of the Black Death, what was that like? You know, I don't think our lives are that different. And I think we must look at the past with far more respect and learn from it. And I certainly think politically we could learn a lot from the past.
That was Francis Pryor. His latest book, Scenes from Prehistoric Life, From the Ice Age to the Coming of the Romans, is out now, published by Head of Zeus. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman and Brittany Colley. Join us again tomorrow when Helen Carr will be speaking about the medieval power broker John of Gaunt.